Good afternoon, Sonoma County and the world. The time is 4 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS-LP, Cal's Radio, broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm, bringing you the Mystical Positivist for the next 2 hours. Cal's Community Radio thanks Minnie Rivers Books and Tea for their generous support. Minnie Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, including books, candles, and sacred art. Minnie Rivers carries fine loose leaf teas and teaware. They also host spiritual talks and classes. Minnie Rivers is located at 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. You can phone them at 707-829-8871 or visit them on the web at www.miniriversbooks.com. Cal's Community Radio wishes to thank Sonoma Clean Power for their underwriting support. Sonoma Clean Power is a local energy provider offering environmentally friendly power at competitive rates. As you may know, you now have a choice of providers, and Sonoma Clean Power offers everyone a competitive marketplace for their power needs. For more information, visit them at sonomacleanpower.org or call toll-free at 855-202-2139. Cal's Community Radio is membership-supported. Everyone who works here does so on a volunteer basis, but there are very real operating costs to keep this station on the air. So we need your support, and one way that you can help support the station is to go to the More Cal's Bell Bar. That's Sunday, May 3rd at Hop Monk. That'll be an all-day benefit for Cal's Community Radio to help us with our antenna project, which is to move our antenna closer to Sebastopol to increase our listenership. There'll be a great arrangement of music. There'll be folks like Dylan Chambers, Lester Chambers, Levi Lloyd, Ricky Ray Band, and many, many more. It's noon to 10:30 p.m. That's Sunday, May 3rd, Hop Monk in Sebastopol.
The More Cowbells Ball.
And $25 gets you a full day of fine entertainment and helping a great cause as well. So that's one way that you can help to keep cows on the air and support locally sourced community radio. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. This week our guest in the studio is the Very Reverend Donald P. Richmond, a priest oblate with the Reformed Episcopal Church and Order of Saint Benedict. Reverend Richmond is a widely published author, poet, and monastic cartoonist.
We'll get started with that conversation after a short musical break. You'll be listening to a movement marked Largo from the Gypsy Sonata in A Minor by Georg Philipp Telemann, performed by the ensemble Red Priest from their CD, Priest on the Run.
This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. This is your host, Stuart Gudnick. Joining me in the studio is my co-host, Dr. Robert Schmidt, director of Taoya Meditation Center and co-founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol.
Great to be here.
This week, our guest by telephone is the Very Reverend Dr. Donald P. Richmond, a priest oblate with the Reformed Episcopal Church and Order of St. Benedict. He is a graduate of several colleges and seminaries, as well as the Robert E. Weber Institute for Worship Studies and the Maryvale Ecclesiastical Institute. Having trained in Byzantine iconography, Father Richmond has a keen interest in the intersection of theology and liturgical arts. A widely published author, Father Richmond has published extensively on the Ancient Future Faith Network and elsewhere also under either the Abbey or the Inner Monk. Of note most recently is Father Richmond's article on the New Monasticism, Under Authority, the Challenge of Evangelical Monasticism. He also has a series of sketches on the Society for the Arts in Religious and Theological Studies, SART's website, entitled The Art of Lectio. Reverend Donald P. Richmond, welcome to The Mystical Positivist.
Thanks for having me here.
It's great to have you, and we will begin by asking you the question we usually ask most of our guests at the start, which is about your religious and spiritual background and any notable moments in your youth and upbringing related to that, which come to mind and you could, in retrospect now, look back on and point to as sort of prefiguring the direction that your life and career would take.
All right. Thank you, Rob, and thank you, Stuart. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your program and share a little bit about myself and my practice. I was raised and educated within a very traditional Roman Catholic single-parent household. And today, we would probably call my mother an evangelical Catholic. Mm. And what I mean by that is she tended toward her Bible as her sure and final authority, and yet she did her worshiping and her training in a Roman Catholic church. And I was raised in that environment by very godly priests, nuns, and religious. My experience of the Roman Catholic Church growing up was nothing but sunshine and light. And from the very earliest time I can remember, probably from age 4 or 5, I felt the permeable presence of God. And at times, I probably felt that presence more from God than I did from my mother. God was suffusing every part of my life, and it wasn't something I was looking for.
Hmm. That's an interesting phrase.
Go ahead.
No. Well, I was it's just an interesting phrase, the permeable presence of God, and I want you to go on where you were going to go earlier, but I also am curious about precisely what you mean by that phrase.
I think of it in the terms of a household. You have a household, you have many different rooms, and if another person is in that house, you sense their presence more frequently than not. Mm-hmm. And my mother was a constant presence in my home. Well, God's presence was even more real and more tangible to me than my mother's physical presence. Hmm. I could not point to God, so to speak, anywhere in the house. It's just within the home, wherever I went, whether it was in church or at school, whether I was walking down the road talking with friends or by myself, God's presence was intimately real to me. I was aware of it, although I wasn't sure what to do with it at age 4, 5, and 6.
Right. So it was permeating your life is what I'm hearing you say.
Correct.
Got it.
I was very sick as a child, and when I was about 5 or 6, my mother, being dirt poor, finally arranged to bring me to a physician, and I experienced, through a very uncanny series of events, a miraculous healing in my life. That just went on to reinforce that presence of God in my life, and it really was a dramatic sort of healing. I was very motivated by a childhood saint by the name of Dominic Savio.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so motivated by this childhood saint called Dominic Savio, I would sneak sticks into the home, and I would sleep on these sticks in order to buffet my body. I thought that somehow by buffeting my body, even though at that age I had no idea what that meant or its purpose, I thought that I could become holy by self-denial, and I was inspired by Dominic Savio to do that. And that really forms the core of what I believe and who I am. I believe that holiness is central to the human person, and the pursuit of holiness is what life is all about. In my teens, my mother moved, and I came under the influence of four exceptional people. Number one was Dr. Robert McAfee Brown and his family. And Bob was an observer at the Second Vatican Council. He was a professor of literature. He was a specialist in liberation theology. He was heavily involved in the anti-war movement. And Bob and his family showed me what it was like to be a family and to have friends. They were wonderful people. And then the other people who largely influenced me were the Reverend Alan and Linda Comstock from Massachusetts, now in Vermont. And these people demonstrated both broad-mindedness and compassion. They were an inspiration to me. At that time, I discovered Thomas Merton and began to read him.
This would be this would be your late teens or something like that?
Mid to late teens.
Okay.
And then I began to visit a commune out in northwestern Massachusetts called the Brotherhood of the Spirit. And from about 1968 to about 1974, I became increasingly involved in countercultural activities. And I began to reevaluate who people were, what philosophy of life I should set my hopes upon, how I should conduct myself, the peace movement, all of those things began to churn within me. But also at the time, I was highly indiscriminate, and so I became increasingly involved in drugs. And then in 1974, that came to a crisis in my life where I had two very unfortunate experiences with drugs and came to Christ and returned to the church and began what I would call a new life. In summary, that was it.
I'm curious if the period when you were involved in countercultural activities and drug use and things like that, did you feel like you were separated from that permeable presence that you'd experienced so early in your life, or was that presence still with you, but outer circumstances were just not firing on all cylinders?
The presence never left me in any way, shape, or form, although I wasn't as aware of it. I became clouded, and it took something abrupt, a crisis in my life, to awaken me to the presence that was always there, and I needed to return to that presence. It had never abandoned me. I had begun to step away from the presence, and I needed to step back into it by the grace of that presence.
And by saying that presence was clouded, would you say that you were simply distracted of mind, or what does clouded mean in this context?
Well, in part, it's distraction. I think that's probably a major problem of our society as a whole. We're distracted by so many things, using a quotation from the Gospel of St. John. But also, because of the things I was doing, I was actively involved in a host of activities that we would call in our tradition sin, that separated me from both the sense of God and as well, I wouldn't say God's presence to me, but my presence to God.
Mm-hmm.
I had instead a sense of separation. God was there, but the sense of separation was also there. And so that it really was a clouding of sin, separation, distance, but yet I knew God was there, present, alive, loving, reaching out.
So without asking you to reveal anything inappropriate or beyond what you want to talk about or are willing to talk about, I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on what sin means in the context that you're just using it. Because I think it's an interesting... It's a word that has been, I think, revisited by a lot of people over the course of my lifetime, and I'm just wondering how you're using the term, what that meant to you at the time, and how that led to your re-engagement with Christian practice.
Okay. A number of years ago, my background is in pastoral counseling and biblical psychology. And I remember probably 25, 30 years ago, a book was written called Whatever Became of Sin. And I'm not sure the author carefully articulated what that meant, but I'm pleased to know that even magazines such as Parabola is revisiting the whole idea of sin. And I look at sin as that in our lives which separates us from God and his sensed presence. And let me acknowledge from the beginning, I don't believe that God is either he or she. God is spirit, but I concede to this way of communicating. I guess from a perspective of the early church, it's the seven deadly sins. We have areas of our lives such as pride, envy, anger, sloth, gluttony, and these things disturb our relationship with a higher power. And unless we address these things, our relationship with God will continue to be clouded. I guess as a teenager, on some level, this expressed itself in all of these ways, but principally in a sexual fashion. I probably did not do anything more unusual than any other teen at the time, but for me, I realized that I was acting not out of my tradition, but I was acting out in a way that was contrary to who I was called to be and contrary to living a holy life. And for me, that created distance. And that distance needed to be bridged. And that can be articulated in the Christian tradition as I needed to be saved, or I needed God, or I needed a reawakening.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to do that, two things had to happen. Number one, the grace of God, the presence of God had to be renewed to me. And the other thing that I needed to do is review what I was doing and stop some of the things I was doing and behave in a different manner. So all of those things came to play for me.
Got it. So grace is presumably... ever available. Some of the clouding you're talking about would be your failure to see the presence of that grace available. Would you agree with that statement?
I think the grace of God is always available to all people at all times in whatever circumstance of life she or he may find themselves in.
Right.
And it is often, if not always, we who decide to move ourselves away from God, whether consciously or unconsciously.
Yeah, that makes sense. So so then, having reached a crisis, as you mentioned earlier, and realizing that a change had to happen, how did that manifest for you? That is, how did you move again towards a godly life, to use the word you used?
The first thing that happened was I remember exactly where I was in Western Massachusetts at the time. I remember exactly what I did and why I had done it. And I was literally laying on the ground and believing or feeling the life beginning to ebb from me. Now, I'm not sure I would have said I was dying or not. I don't know, but this is the feeling that I had.
Mm-hmm. Something about the vitality.
Yes.
Leaving.
Yes, exactly. And I remember calling out, because I was raised in an environment where, as I mentioned earlier, God was permeably present. I knew who God was. I was just avoiding that contact. And so I cried out at the time, Lord, save me, and I'll serve you. And so the first thing that happened for me was I had to come to a point of crisis, and I think that's the same for most people. We have to come to some place where we recognize our need. And then the second thing is call out. And it's not so much that God rides, so to speak, to our rescue. It's more like a curtain. God was there, and the curtain is moved because we have removed barriers that have prevented us from, so to speak, seeing and experiencing and knowing God. And with that, I really began to feel life re-enter me. And with that new life, so to speak, re-entering me, I realized that I had to live differently. I could no longer live the life that I was living before, and I needed to make a decision whether I was going to live for my own will or in my own way, or I was going to live on behalf of God and for the benefit of other human beings. I knew in the past that God was my priority and that human beings were most important in my life and in the life of the world, but I ignored it until this point. And so then I had to just take action. I had to live according to the commitment that I had made.
Right. So, of course, this is the perennial question that people come to. How does one live and honor a commitment such as the one you made when you cried out for help from God? So in your case, I mean, it's different for different people, obviously, because we are differently constituted. In your case, how did living differently and keeping your commitment manifest?
I think it begins with small steps, and you didn't say this, but I think you hinted at this. I'm sure that both you and Stuart have been to the UK.
We have.
Yes.
And if you've ever gone to the UK and visited a variety of sites in the middle of nowhere, you inevitably get lost. And my advice is never ask a local, because if you ask a local how to get to a particular site, the invariable answer is, well, I wouldn't begin from here. But of course, we have to begin from where we are.
Right.
And I think that ties to both my life and the lives of other human beings. We begin where we are. We can't begin where we would like to be.
Right.
We have to begin from the ground up, and that was for me. A beginning. And what that meant on the outside was I needed to start being around people who had as their primary concern the love of God and the love of their neighbor. I needed to begin religious practices. As an example of one of many, I needed to read my Bible. I had to practice Lectio Divina. I had to meditate. As well, because I'm in vital connection with other human beings, I needed to treat other people with dignity. As I mentioned earlier, as with probably most teenagers of the time, I liked sleeping around. But yet, when I did that, I recognized that that was using another human being, even though they were consensual in the process. The bottom line was, it was more about me than it was about them or us. And I realized that I could not treat people without dignity and call myself a Christian. And of course, that plays out not just in the area of human sexuality, but in every area, according to the biblical narrative, which makes perfect sense to me. You cannot love God who you do not see unless you love your neighbor who you do see. And so I began a long process of learning, how do I practically love my neighbor? How do I love the person who I frankly don't like, let alone love? How do I get along with those whose positions and opinions are different than mine? How do I treat anyone with dignity? And they have very practical applications, hands and feet, and so I had to learn that. And then I think primarily, more than anything else, I had to come down to the point of humility where I recognized my entire impoverishment, that I had lived my life on my own terms, and it got me to a place of what Alcoholics Anonymous calls deflation at depth. There was nothing left of me, and I needed to be at that point in order to be built up to the person I needed to be.
So I'm interested to know if in some of these issues that you're describing, we have deep-seated habit patterns on how we treat other people. And for instance, the voices in our minds that create judgments and create separation with others by virtue of judgment. Mm-hmm. And in some spiritual traditions, there are practices and engagements and, you know, training for addressing that. But often that's done in the context of, you know, a mentorship or or some sort of guidance. So were you coming to this on your own? Would you say there was a heightened functioning of conscience operating all of a sudden? Or were you being mentored in this path at this time?
I think both for me were taking place. In many ways, I was mentored by the dead. Thomas Merton had died just about the time when all of these shifts in my life began to take place. And I was, at that time, a very heavy reader. And so books like books on Zen, books on Taoism, books that are rooted within the Christian tradition, the Desert Fathers and the Desert Mothers, all of these people who existed in the past were made available to me. As well, I was part of a Christian community where people could help to heal me. And then there were one or two people who came alongside and helped me to live the life. And I can give you two or three examples of this. I realized that if I was to live with the friends I was living with, and I want to suggest very clearly that there was absolutely nothing wrong with my friends. They were good people. They were generous and compassionate people. They were educated people. These were fine people. It was about me, not about them. But I knew that if I did not get away from these people, I would be quickly drawn back into my old lifestyle. And so for a matter of 3 or 4 months, a deacon in the church had me help him build his house in the woods. And so all day long, I would help him build his house, and in the evening, he would mentor me in the truths of the faith.
Got it.
Similarly, there was a very old woman who invited me into her home, and she too educated me in the faith. She came alongside. She was my spiritual mentor, my spiritual director. So all of these things, books, Christian community, as well as individuals, came to my rescue.
Got it. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. This week our guest in the studio is the Very Reverend Donald P. Richmond, a priest oblate with the Reformed Episcopal Church and Order of St. Benedict. Reverend Richmond is a widely published author, poet, and monastic cartoonist.
So I really appreciated what you had to say about putting yourself in the company of people who are doing different things than the company of people you had been previously associating with. It's actually precisely mirrored in the Buddhist sutras and suttas of the Pali tradition, where the Buddha is constantly advocating that if you want to shift what you're doing in your life, you have to spend time with people who basically support that or are themselves engaged in making such an attempt.
Absolutely. And we need other people. And I'm a firm believer that we never move beyond the company we keep. And what I mean by that is that I don't think there are really any masters. We're all students. We are all, in one way or another, moving toward the divine. And that's a pretty extreme statement, and I mean that, because I believe even in our worst state, even in absolute ignorance, we are moving towards God, although in a way that is contrary to God.
Oh, sure.
All our desires, all our actions in some way are a reflection of the love of God and a desire for the divinity. How we get there, or if we get there, are two different questions altogether.
Sure, it's hard to argue because if God has the qualities that are generally attributed, then God created all these apparent, what we interpret as or experience as obstacles, as well as the opposite.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you mentioned obstacles. When we talk about obstacles, I like to think in terms of stumbling blocks and stepping stones. And for me, there's really no difference between a stumbling block and a stepping stone. They're the same thing. It's how we use them.
That sounds like Richard Rohr, if I'm not mistaken. He uses that that same language.
Okay.
But it's interesting, this idea of having to move into a different circle is reminiscent for me of my own spiritual practice. When I moved into a spiritual community or a spiritual school, I was pulling myself away for a period of time from very deep friendships and relationships I had with people who weren't engaged in that kind of work. And I really feel the comment you made, these aren't bad people, and many of them are my friends today. But for at least a period of time, for me, I had to separate out so that I could dwell in a different way of being. And it was only until I could be stabilized in that I could return, as it were, to the marketplace and relate with these friends from a different place, but also honor the connections that we had in our lives.
Absolutely. And although I don't regret in any way the decision that I made back then, I needed it for my spiritual survival. I do at times wish that I had taken the time or the opportunity to renew some of those relationships. Over the years, I was able to do that with some of them, but not all of them. But I think this hints as well as at a quotation that I really love. And I believe it's by Noah Ben-Shea in his book, Jacob the Baker. He said, "We are the wilderness we must pass over in order to enter the promised land." And it's really not about other people and unfortunate circumstances. It's really about us and our journey and how God is guiding us in that journey, and whether we're going to follow God or not.
Well, that makes sense, and it leads me to another, but I think related topic, which is the Benedictine rule and Benedictine spiritual, what's sometimes now called Benedictine spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you, or at least I've read that you have some connection to that and deep cultivation of it. So it's relevant because we've been talking about how we relate with people. And, of course, Benedict was a fellow who was helping to create a way for these monastics to live together. So I'm curious to hear your experience of that, and also when you get to it, to talk about, because I was reading in some of the material that you have published online, the use of Benedictine spirituality in the context not just of monastics, but also of non-monastics, and specifically referring to parishes, which is, of course, people not separated from the world. So if you could begin to talk about that, I think that would be that would illuminate even more broadly this topic of how we spend time with other people in order to spend more time with God, as it were.
Sure. At the beginning of my pastoral ministry, I was placed in the subarctic. And it was exceptionally isolated, and it was exceptionally lonely.
Was this in Canada or the U.S.?
This was in Canada. This was in Canada. And I began to develop a hunger within me for community. And certainly, to some degree, I had that among the parishioners that I was serving. I was fellowshipping ecumenically with other church communities, members of church communities, but I felt that I needed something a little more in-depth, something a little more personal, something that would give me more discipline in my life. It's not that I was ever, particularly after returning to Christ, undisciplined. I'm a fairly disciplined person. When I make a decision, I follow through. But I felt that I needed that additional discipline, and I was desperate for deeper community. And so at that time, I aligned with the Society of St. John the Evangelist, which is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was what was called an associate, sort of like a Benedictine oblate. And ever since that time, I have been associated with a monastic community. Now, after 20 years with the Society of St. John the Evangelist, after having lived a decade out in Southern California, I aligned with the Order of St. Benedict at St. Andrew's Abbey in Vallejo, California. But all of it was driven by this need for community, something deeper than just going to church and having fellowship meetings, but actually living a life in fellowship with other people and seeing all of their warts and difficulties and struggles, and yet maintaining stability in that community. That was very important to me.
So just so I'm clear, though, when we speak about community, it is community with a common aim, though, an aim to orient one's life in relationship to God.
Right, but it works two ways at the same time. It is a community devoted to prayer, which means enhancing our relationship with God. But in order to do that, we need to become more stable with other people. We live in an unstable world where if we don't happen to like the town we're in or the church we're in or the community we're in, we just shift and go elsewhere. We do church shopping, church hopping, and if this religious practice doesn't seem to tickle our fancy, we go to another religious practice. And Thomas Merton refers to a gluttony for words. But we as people have gluttony for new experiences and new communities. And one of the things that we need to learn is that stability is the most effective means of spiritual growth. Living with the same people day in, day out, week after week, month after month, year after year, with all of the personalities that are represented, with all of the diversity, with all of the difficulty, the reality is these are the people that God has placed with me to pursue holiness. And without them, I cannot be a holy person. It's the person who aggravates me and irritates me, and I irritate and aggravate her or him, while maintaining that relationship, that's what helps me grow. So I needed to be embedded in that, not just do it casually.
It's interesting when you speak about people today, Westerners today, Americans today, having a hunger for new experiences and this attitude that if I don't like my church, I'll change my church. If I, don't like my neighbor, I'll move or maybe have a lawsuit or something. But it seems like there's this unconscious principle that whatever is going to make us right is going to be found outside of ourselves. So if I reconfigure the external circumstances, then everything's going to be okay, which leads people in this endless chase for the right set of external circumstances.
Absolutely.
And what I hear you saying is that actually the reverse is the case, that in order to stabilize, to ultimately deepen our relationship with God, we have to find that within and find the resources within to make whatever is manifesting itself to us okay.
Yes. I would generally agree with that, and I think, as you probably think as well, that would have to be nuanced. Mm-hmm. As an example, if we are in an abusive circumstance, then we probably should get out of that circumstance,
right,
and be safe. But in the communities in which I've participated, mainly the Society of St. John the Evangelist in Cambridge and then the Order of St. Benedict in Vallejermo, California, I'm not talking about abusive relationships. I'm talking about the normal process of life. And we're a mobile society, but that doesn't always serve our or God's purposes for us. And I think, whether applied to the church or to other religious traditions, church hopping and church shopping is counterproductive, is, in my opinion, dangerous. We do ourselves more harm than good by that.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that. And I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit more specifically about what a Benedictine approach to community. You've outlined the stability aspect nicely, but what else is it about Benedictine spirituality that attracts you, and that you have worked with?
Well, I actually believe that all of life is about love. And no matter what you may know, no matter how many degrees and certifications we may have accrued over the years, they amount to absolutely nothing unless we love God and love our neighbor. Now, if we look at Benedictine spirituality and living within a monastic community, within the context of we are doing this to come closer to God, and the principal way by which we come closer to God is prayer, we need to focus on what the center of prayer is. And I think we get a hint of that in the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples. Jesus said this: "Forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. And when you are forced to live in a community with people who are all too apparently human, we're having to forgive again and again and again and again and again. It challenges us to do that. And that's what attracts me, amongst a whole host of other things, to the Order of Saint Benedict. You are forced to take your prayer, your God, and other people seriously. And if you're going to be a person of prayer, you have to be a person who's rooted in forgiveness and who is willing, and I use this word only slightly tongue-in-cheek, you have to be willing to be crucified on a daily basis. And that's not an easy way to live, but it's the only way to live.
So metaphorically, by crucified, can you, what is that specifically? Is it the enduring or being present to the apparent suffering of the annoyances of others and holding that and rising to a higher intention in relationship to the other person?
Yes, I think that would be an accurate assessment of that. It's a recognition that, let me backtrack a bit. Liturgy, the process of worship, is about life. It isn't separated from life. So when I go to prayer, it's not about some devotional practice that is empty of how I live with other people. It's all about how I live with other people. Now, in the practice of a formal and a fixed liturgy, there's a place where you go to your sister or your brother and you say, "The peace of the Lord be always with you," and you give them a hug or shake their hand. Well, that means something, and you can't be hypocritical in doing that. And so if you've just had an argument with this sister or brother, if you're in a long struggle with them, how do I exercise daily this mercy, this forgiveness, this generosity, this presence to them? And it forces me to do that every time I pray, I meditate, I encounter them. And that is, to me, why living in a monastic community — I don't live in the community, but I'm attached to the community — but why the community of monasticism is so dear to me. I need that, because it's easy to think that it's me, myself, and I. And my spirituality belongs to me alone, but it doesn't. I belong to others, they belong to me. How am I going to navigate that in the midst of life's horrors and hardships and difficulties and sorrows?
Got it. It's interesting that in the tradition that Rob and I have worked in, which has some resonance with the Gurdjieff tradition, there's this notion of friction. And people in relationship, in the context that you're describing, produce a certain kind of friction. And if you can hold, as I said, with a higher intent and a higher purpose, the frictional heat that's generated when we have to withstand and not react to, let's say, our darker, pettier impulses in relationship to someone else, that energy has a transformative potency for us.
Absolutely. One of the things that I'm really excited about these days, because I've been meditating quite consistently on this for probably a year now, if you look at the Beatitudes, which are found in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 5, they are transformative, and it hints at some of the things we've talked about already. We begin the Beatitudes with, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." We all have to begin with this essential poverty of spirit, personal poverty, social poverty, and until we recognize that essential poverty and embrace humility, we can't move on. But then the next logical step is, "Blessed are those who mourn." So if we've really recognized our need, our poverty, it is quite natural for us to mourn over it. The next step is a logical extension of these two. If you are truly impoverished, if you are truly sorrowed and grieving over this impoverishment, then what happens is you begin to develop humility. And here's where the fun begins. Once you've achieved that sense of humility, the next step is found in verse 6. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And I think that's what all human beings are hungering and thirsting for. One of the 20th century's greatest philosophers said this: life's greatest sorrow is not to be a saint. And I absolutely believe that. I'm convinced of that. And so we have this hunger and thirst for righteousness. But the question is, how do we move from the hunger for righteousness to the purity of heart that God calls us to have? And I find it very interesting that between verse 6, which is the hunger, and verse 8, which is the purity, falls mercy. And the only way we move into practical holiness is by the exercise of mercy towards other people. So if we think that holiness is something that falls upon us and we're miraculously changed, we're mistaken. It's only by exercising mercy that practical holiness is realized. And I think that's a wonderful concept. It's very exciting to me, at least.
So in your understanding of this, is the exercise of mercy, does it begin with the, what I'd call the exterior form of being merciful, which then becomes a crucible for the transformation of our spirit into being merciful?
Yes, absolutely. We've experienced it, we exercise it, and then in exercising it, it forms a crucible, and we're deepened in that. And that crucible burns the dross of our unholy dispositions away, and we become purer. But it's only by that exercise of mercy in difficult circumstances that empowers us to do that. Now, don't misunderstand me. I think the grace of God comes to bear on this, and it's not my work. It's God's work in, with, and through me and through other people. But yet, we have to exercise the mercy.
Well, it seems to me that one of the most difficult areas to exercise mercy, at least in my experience, is towards myself. Mm-hmm. And that would be the area where the grace is most needed.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates the context where we can move effectively to offer mercy to others. But I want to get back. I want to get back to this question that I asked a large question earlier. So we're just okay. Getting to it piecemeal here. I asked about the distinction between the monastic context and a non-monastic context for the application of the principles of the Rule of Benedict. Can you talk about that a bit?
If I've understood the question properly, I think there's a couple of things that come to bear. Number one, to some degree, there's no difference.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're relational beings, and we're all placed within a community. We come from and are embedded within some form of a community. I think it's intensity and intentionality that make the difference. I, as an example, attend a church. If I'm not preaching, I'm attending a church. I attend fellowship meetings, and I have relationships with these people. But at the end of the day, apart from my wife, we go home, and that's the end. And if there's a particular need, we call. We pray, but that's not quite the same as making a deliberate choice to live with, in some way or another, 25 different men and or women who have made the same commitment to live in a community, come hell or high water, for the rest of your life. Mm. It's like a marriage. And you don't get the same thing from going to church and having fellowship meetings as you do when you commit yourself to some form of a marriage, whether it's with a spouse, a partner, or with a religious community.
Well, that of course,
intensity and intentionality.
I think you've nailed those two principles. Make complete sense to me, and I also wonder. I don't know what a fellowship meeting exactly means, but I'm guessing at what it might mean. I'm wondering if there isn't something in between the haphazard experience of community that most Americans have grown up with, certainly my experience of that.
Well, that's why I wrote that rather extended article on building Benedictine communities or building mm-hmm. Benedictine churches. I think there is a middle ground, and I think it's hinted at in the new monasticism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what it involves is our making a decision to not be superficial with one another, to
right.
be real with one another, to let people know where we're really at, where we really need help, and to be committed to come to each other's assistance at any time, at any place, and anywhere. And we can do that, but in our church hopping and church shopping society, we're often not afforded the opportunity, or we don't take the opportunity. And so we miss many opportunities for encouragement and embrace because of that. And I think it's a very simple fix. You just decide that you're going to be committed to these group of people, and you make a mutual, intentional community to live that way for the rest of your life.
Got it. I'm wondering if there isn't. I'm just exploring. I'm in complete agreement with you, and I'm just exploring here notionally for a moment the idea of creating some way to express that commitment to this intention in a way that would be more than just to yourself. Do you see what I'm saying? Where I'm going with that? I mean, it's some way of making that kind of commitment. I mean, when you join a monastic community, surely you're doing so by accepting the vows that you undertake.
Sure. If I again understand your question properly, there is a practical way to do this, and I think it's hinted at in the Book of Acts. It says in the Book of Acts that no one was needy amongst the brethren.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the commitments we make in an intentional community is to share what we have. And so if my sister or my brother is in practical need of one of my five coats, I give him my coat. If I have to give up my daily cup of latte in order to put food on my sister or my brother's table, I give up my cup of latte. And so I think that's one of the practical ways we can do it. I share not just myself, but my time, my talent, and my treasures to other people. They're at, to some degree, their disposal. An example of this would be, I don't have a problem. My wife and I have an extra room in our home. If somebody in my community was in need of this room, which is my office, I would clear out the room and they would have my office. And I think that's just part of being a community. Does that make sense? Is that
yeah.
where you're moving towards?
That's exactly right. We need to go into our break now so we can continue this discussion after the break.
Okay.
All right. The time is 5 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS LP Cal's Radio. broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. This week our guest in the studio is the Very Reverend Donald P. Richmond, a priest oblate with the Reformed Episcopal Church and Order of Saint Benedict. Reverend Richmond is a widely published author, poet, and monastic cartoonist. So stay tuned for that discussion after our break. Cows Community Radio thanks the Sonoma County Gazette for their support. The Sonoma County Gazette is a free monthly newspaper with a print and online circulation estimated at 100,000 and is distributed to newsstands, coffee shops, restaurants, and various stores countywide. The Gazette covers local news as well as social and environmental issues. Their calendar highlights local classes, meetings, arts events, and entertainment venues. Visit them on the web at SonomaCountyGazette.com. Cows Radio thanks Studio E for their underwriting support. Founded in 1983, they are located in Sebastopol and feature a recording, mixing, and mastering facility with a full range of production services. Their facility is also available for special events. You can reach them at 707-823-5316 or visit them on Facebook by searching for Studio E Music Production. The Living Room is located at 636 Cherry Street in Santa Rosa and offers support services and daytime shelter for homeless women and children. For more information about the program, call 707-579-0142 or visit their Facebook page by looking them up on facebook.com/The Living Room Center. Cows Community Radio is membership supported, and there is a great way for you to help the herd out and
have a great day coming up a week from tomorrow on Sunday, May 3rd.
If you need more cowbell,
we've got a ball for you.
Yes, the more cows bell bar ball.
More cows bells ball.
More cows bell ball is happening at Hop Monk on Sunday, May 3rd. This is almost all day. It's from noon to 10:30 p.m. A benefit for Cows Community Radio for our project to help move our antenna from the mountains behind Occidental to the ridges between Occidental and Sebastopol to increase our listenership in downtown Sebastopol. There'll be music performers, Dylan Chambers, Lester Chambers, the Mud Stompers, Midnight Transit, Ricky Ray Band, Levi Lloyd, and many more. That's noon to 10:30 p.m. There'll be a raffle and silent auction. $25 gets you a day of entertainment. So we hope to see you there. That's more cowbells bar ball Sunday, May 3rd at Hop Monk in Sebastopol.
It's hard to say.
It is hard to say.
So we'll return to our conversation with Reverend Donald Richmond after a short musical break. You'll be listening to a movement marked Andante from the Concerto in D Major called Priest on the Run, by Antonio Vivaldi, performed by the ensemble Red Priest from their CD entitled Priest on the Run.